Welcome to this week's episode of the Payers and Players podcast. Before we start today's episode, if you would, jump on Twitter and follow us at Payers Players. We're working hard weekly to bring you content that's valuable. And so if you would, on Twitter, subscribe to us so that you can get access to all of the newest subscriber-only content. Thanks so much. And with that, let's crank up today's episode. Well, hello and welcome to episode 78 of the Payers and Players podcast. We've got an exciting episode for you today. Scott, you want to introduce today's guest?
Absolutely. We've got Rod Ray. Rod is the head coach at Wofford College, where he's been the head coach since the year 2000. Rod played collegiately at East Tennessee State, and he has coached over 13 all-conference players during his time at Wofford. So, Rod, welcome to the show. Glad to have you on. Could you give us a little bit of background on about Wofford and how your all seasons went this last year?
Right. Well, thank you. This is really fun for me to be here with you guys. So thank you for having me. Wofford College. We're in Spartanburg, South Carolina. We play in the Southern Conference, mid-major Division I. Fantastic school. Good team. Got American players, player from all over the world, play a great schedule. Super fun.
And give us a little bit of background on your season this year. I know you guys have some adversities and some things, were a little bit of a struggle this year in terms of injuries and players and everything. So just give us a little bit of background there.
Yeah, what a year. So started out the year really excited about the season. Played a good fall schedule. Took some guys to Tulsa, Oklahoma to the All-American. We're at the regional tournament at Duke in Cary, North Carolina, hosted by Duke, and one of our players, Mark Endler, goes into a cardiac arrest, falls on the court, no heartbeat, no pulse. What seemed like an eternity, he was essentially gone and was resuscitated, and medical people did an unbelievable job. 8 days later, he had surgery at the Duke Cardiac Center, he made it. And what a year right there. We thought we lost a teammate, and great comeback by Mark. He lived and is doing great. But he was one of our best players, and we lost him from our lineup. Another one of our guys who would have played in the top three. Mark would have played in the top three. Another guy who would have played in the top three broke his wrist in February and was out for the season. So you lose two of your top three. It's going to be a learning season for sure. And it was.
Yeah. And so what did you learn about your team from that experience and that adversity?
Oh, my gosh. So if you lose two of your top three, that means everybody moves up, right?
Yep.
So everybody's playing in a new spot. I was pretty excited about this team, and I still am excited about this team, but we had a hard schedule. I mean, we played a great schedule. We played a lot of really good mid-majors. We played some really good power fives. I scheduled hard because I thought we had a really good team and we were going to get some chances. What I learned about these guys is they didn't quit. I mean, we lost a lot of matches, but we tried hard, and these guys grew together. And it was, I learned so much about people. I learned, young people. I learned about fight. I learned about toughness from these guys. Losing is no fun, but losing is a fantastic classroom for learning.
Right.
Yeah, when I look online, I'm looking at your schedule. Y'all played North Carolina twice, Clemson twice, Mercer, Appalachian State, Chattanooga. It's a good schedule, like you said.
Yeah.
And then also looking at the UTR of your guys, You know, this is, I tell parents all the time, go have your child go somewhere that they will play. You know, why do you want a kid who's an 11 and a half UTR, they're going to go to a place that's in the SEC and they're never going to get on the court? So what I see from your roster is really a cool opportunity for players, because they're going to get to play really good competition. And if they have what it takes and can continue to get better, they might, I mean, they can show what they can do.
Yeah. We're going to be a developmental program. I mean, I'm going to recruit really hard. We've got some good players coming in. I mean, you want to improve your team. You need to recruit really well. And I've done that. But we get better gosh, you know, I've done this for just finished my 23rd season. I was kind of thinking back. I've had three guys in 23 years go somewhere else and play.
So when they get there, they like it.
When they come here, they stay. They like it. We do a great job. Fantastic school. I love the players. I mean, I love the players.
Rod, and you just had a player that was competing at the French Open. Tell us a little bit about Rob and, you know, how he's developed from a player that was playing at Wofford that's now playing in the Grand Slams.
Okay. Rob Galloway lost second round of the French Open a couple of days ago in doubles. He's in England at a challenger right now, right outside of London, playing with JP Smith this week, who won the NCAA, played for Tennessee, was an All-American every time he was there, probably. And Rob's 80 in the world in ATP doubles. I got to go to Wimbledon with him last year. He's played in three U.S. Opens. He's a really good doubles player, and you know, but he was a good player for us. But he's one of those guys that you go, wait a minute, how did he do that? Because he played five junior tournaments from the time he was 14 to 18.
Wow.
Okay, so he's an outlier. And he came here Rob came to a camp that I was having, and I liked his drive. I liked his eyes. I liked his grit. And I offered him a little bitty scholarship, and he really didn't have any other offers. And he worked hard and earned a spot at like five his freshman year, played one his junior, senior year, and became a really good player. He was a good singles player, but he's a double specialist right now.
Yeah. So talk about a little bit about his, you know, you said he only played like four tournaments from the time he was, or five tournaments from 14 to 18. Yeah. Was he a multi-sport player? Was he just a kid that played locally? Was he a guy that's like 6'10" that was able to, you know, do something? Tell us a little bit more about his development.
So Rob was a good 12 and under player. His father was a good player. His grandfather was a great player. But he goes off to prep school in Virginia and played where he had to play multiple sports. He was young. He grew late. He was when he came to Wofford, he was like a little boy. He was a little boy with a whole lot of fight. So he had a tennis background, so to speak, but at the prep school it was required that they play other sports. They had classes on Saturdays, so travel wasn't really an option. He played high school tennis, like pretty good high school tennis. But you know, when he came here, he didn't come here to become a pro player. He came here to get a great education.
And then yeah, And like I said, that's just one of those things where, you know, you don't want to. I think Eric Budorak has a great speech. You know, he was a, you know, a former D3 college player that went on to, you know, make the finals of the Australian Open. But, you know, he said, you know, dream small. You know, if you go in there thinking I'm going to be a pro player or nothing, then you know, when the things don't look good for you, you're going to quit. But if you just, you know, don't have those expectations, you know, take each day as a, you know, just trying to get 1% better, who knows where you're going to end up. I mean, like you say, you know, if this guy came to Wofford thinking I'm going to go play Grand Slams after Wofford, he probably wouldn't have been achieving that dream if he had that mindset.
Right. So Eric Budorak played D1 at the bottom of the lineup, transferred, played D3, became one of the best players in the country, Division 3, dabbled in pro singles for a while, kind of just was going to give it a go, tried for a while, and then made over $1 million a year playing doubles later. I go to a seminar, a coaching convention, and I hear Eric Budorak talk, and I come back and I look at Rob and say, he did it. You can do it too. Go for it.
Yeah.
And so that's, I know exactly what you're talking about, but Rob took a chance right there. I mean, he took a chance. I mean, when he went pro, people were like, he's doing what? Why is he doing that? You know? Well, because he believes he can do it. That's why he's doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I say, the pro pathway, you know, it's there for anyone to take a shot at. You know, it's like you see some of these tournaments that don't even fill up. So, you know, if you've got that dream and you have that passion, you know, there's no real barriers to giving that a shot because it's all on you.
Scott, it's super hard. I mean, it's incredibly difficult. But what we know is that tennis players mature. You know, we know that guys are our brains are still developing into our mid and sometimes late 20s. Physically, mentally, and emotionally, we're probably peaking at about 30. So you're college players, you're chasing a moving target. You're not gonna reach your potential while you're in college. Go for it. Right. Go for it. Yep. You're not gonna catch it. Yep. Not when you're in college. Yep.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, and hey, you know, so one of the things that I thought was really good about, you know, your background is that not only are you a college coach, but you're also a tennis parent. And so before we, you know, get too far down the college pathway, I want to talk a little bit about you being a tennis parent and, you know, raising Ash. And I know you have another son who plays, I think, cross country at a different school. So, you know, you've raised a couple of athletes that have gone on to D1 programs. So tell us a little bit about, you know, Ash's background in tennis and how, you know, your thoughts were on his development as he was growing up.
Yeah, love talking about Ash. Thanks. Who doesn't like talking about his son, right?
Sure.
I think an advantage that Ash and I had was I coached kids before I had Ash. So I was a junior coach before I had a son who played. I think an advantage was that, you know, as a college coach, I was gone a lot. So Ash, I mean, I coached Ash in the juniors. I was one of his coaches in the juniors. But I had another child who needed a whole lot of attention, and I had a full-time job that requires a lot of work. So I had, you know, I was gone a lot, and so Ash grew up coming to my camp. He played multiple sports. I can remember him playing church league basketball and him saying, you know, him getting to the point where he said, I don't want to do this anymore because I want to be a great tennis player. And you know, and I think the multiple sport was great for him, but that was pretty early on that he had this bug inside of him that he said, I want to be a great tennis player. And he did grow up around college tennis. Incredibly driven kid. I mean, there's just not anybody who works harder than Ash Ray on the tennis court. I would say that I'm a partner with Ash. Like at a young age, you know, when I was coaching Ash, I mean, I got to go. I mean, that was kind of the thing. And can't we do more? No, I got to go. I got a bunch of other people waiting on me and that kind of thing. And I think that helped him.
How so?
Well, because it was never me pushing it.
Right.
I mean, as a tennis coach, did I want my son to play tennis? Of course I did. You know, of course I did. But my time with Ash was a luxury.
Right. Yeah, okay. I think you bring up a point that's real challenging. I had somebody say this to me the other day. If a parent has a child who's talented in tennis and the child decides to go on this competitive route, if the child doesn't want to do it, then it's probably child abuse. But if the child does want to do it, then it's probably parent abuse. And I thought that was pretty funny. To your point, there's a lot of parents out there who have talented kids, but if the kids don't want it worse than the parent wants it for them, then it's not going to work. It has to be driven by the kid. And I think that's hard for a lot of parents because they see the talent in their child, but they don't see the drive. And so you just can't create the drive.
It's never about talent. So go with me on this for a minute. When I recruit kids, I never miss on talent. I miss on drive and determination. I miss on passion for tennis sometimes. And I'm not alone in that. We're getting the science, so to speak, of is that person a good athlete? I can check that box. Yep, I can figure that. I think we can do that. Numerous things that would go into that from a scientific standpoint, whether they're a tennis player or they participate in track or basketball. How they move, their movement, their hand-eye coordination, their quickness, their how they accelerate, how they decelerate, are they fast twitch, slow twitch, these kind of things. We can figure that out pretty easily. Where we miss on as college coaches is drive and determination. So you go back to a parent, their child checks all the boxes, they're a great athlete, they do all those things I just mentioned well. It comes easy to them. That doesn't mean they want to be a great player.
Right. And so how do you, you know, sort of try to get into a player's psyche to see where their drive is? Is there some tricks that you might have in terms of recruiting that you can sort of, you know, sense for it, or some things that you might see in their social media that would indicate, you know, this kid's, you know, he's totally bought in, or, hey, you know, he's following a bunch of, you know, rappers, and, you know, the things he's looking at really sort of show where his mind is.
Yeah.
Are there some things that you might look at?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, there's all kinds. I mean, people have different interests, right? I mean, that's fantastic. I mean, every guy on my team has different interests in each other. The common thread through it all is that they're passionate about tennis. But they may like, you know, they have all kinds of different interests, and that's really healthy. I like that. And that's one of the benefits about being on a team is you get to, I mean, we've got people from, you know, we get on the bus and we've got all these different interests, and it's really cool. I think that the thing that like on our team, that the threat is these are super competitive people. Okay. So when Wofford College, last weekend I was at a wedding, with a former player he grew up in Rome, Georgia, Michael Schechter's wedding. And, he was a great player for us. He was probably, Michael's probably 5'7", left-handed fighter, was a good player for us. There were 10 guys there, who were his teammates. Every one of those guys is uber successful right now. Why? Because they're super competitive, smart people. They were good players. We had a good team. And that's what it is. They're highly competitive, honest, hardworking people.
Yeah. I think the question though is, I mean, you look at in the NFL, Jamarcus Russell gets drafted by the Raiders and all the skill set, and even the Raiders missed on evaluating desire. And is this a football junkie? You know?
Yeah.
How do you, I think Scott's question is, how do you, because the other stuff is easy to measure, how do you measure that piece?
Yeah. So we're looking for that gym rat, right? I mean, we're looking for that. If like I mentioned, if the targets move, if the target's way out there, they're not going to meet their potential while they're in college, but I'm looking for that player who wants to be a great player. I mean, they want to be a great player with every fiber of their being, right? And when I say that, you can hear that in my voice. That's what I'm looking for. I'm passionate about that. Well, I can tell when you can tell passion, right? You can tell, and you're asking questions like, you know, like what? Tell me about what you've had to overcome. I mean, that's one of the. Tell me about the adversity you've faced. Tell me about what you've had to overcome. Well, you know, I got a guy coming this year. He's a good student. He rode the train an hour to practice early, before school every day, an hour each way.
Whoa, hold on. Tell us about that. He rode the train an hour? Is he a foreign guy?
Yeah, he's from Scotland.
New York or something?
He's from Scotland, but this particular kid. But he's from Scotland. He's smart, but that's not easy for him, right? So I'm looking for a player who's got skin in the game.
Yeah, heck yeah. That you know he likes tennis if he's willing to get up, ride the train, ride that man. That shows some dedication there.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's competitive, right? He's got skin in the game. And that's what we're looking for, you know. So let's say it's an American kid and he's going to an academy. Well, I mean, I'm gonna do my homework, right? And tell me
which homework includes what?
Getting to know his coaches.
And so you're asking the coaches, does he come on time? Does he come early? Does he like to be here? Does he want to be here? Does he skip? All that kind of stuff.
Who's the hardest working kid in your group?
Right.
Is it him? No, he's not. He's not. He doesn't work very hard. I mean, so now I got to find out a little bit more, right? I mean, that doesn't. I mean, you know, I'm a mid-major. I'm digging. I'm looking for people that, you know, I'm not always getting that blue chip, but I'm getting really good players. You know, where I knock it out of the park, where I get that kid who's, you know, for D1, who's a little bit under the radar, but has a fire in their belly, and maybe athletically has some upswing. Now we're okay. I'm kind of seeing some intangibles in here. This kid really wants to be a good player. What are really good players like to do? You know, what are you demonstrating? Not what are you saying, but what are you demonstrating? So that's the hard thing for coaches. And I'm, you know, I mean, if there's other coaches who are listening to this, they're going, yep. That's it.
Well, what percentage of your roster is foreign?
Next year it'll be about 50%, probably. Let's see.
Yeah. And know that this is a person asking that doesn't lament foreign players in college tennis. I think they actually make college tennis better. So I'm not asking with an agenda there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, let's see. This year we had 8 guys on our team. Mark, who I mentioned, who had the challenge with the heart, was from Spain. And then I had Callum from England and Max from England. So,
and can you generalize what you see in the difference of drive between, and I know that there's exceptions in both directions, but, you know, my personal observation is that the foreign folks tend to come a little more independent, a little more driven, because they you know, they made a big investment to get here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see as the difference there?
There are some, we know that some, like, characteristics of certain countries. Some are true. Some stereotypes are true sometimes, and some are not. But I think the neat thing is, like, I might get a kid from England and he's on my team, and then he realizes, you know, I got more in common with that kid from Greenville, South Carolina, than I do the other guy from England. And that's kind of a neat thing. But I think they're really hungry American kids, and they're really hungry kids from Germany, and they're really hungry kids from France, and really hungry kids from Argentina and Spain. I've had a number of great kids from Spain.
What I love about what you're saying is, I think the opinion of people, the opinion I gave is not my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I gave it for the purpose of the question, but I hear a lot of people give that opinion. And to me, it's almost a lazy opinion. It's a, we're not working hard enough to do the things you're doing to find out about the players. Mm-hmm. And so they're getting kids just based on UTR or something, and then they come and they don't work quite as hard, right? You're doing the homework.
You know, I've got an American kid coming next year who's under the radar, you know, and I went and saw him play, and he, a little bit of a late starter and late bloomer. Great kid. And I mean, so when I say great kid, I've had five people tell me that have worked with him that he's an unbelievable person. He's going to work really hard, but he's going to be a really good teammate. I think I got that one right. You know, I hope I got that one right. You know, I start my summer camp on Sunday. I've got five of my six returning players coming back and working my camp with me next week. They'll be practicing at crazy hours. They'll be in the gym lifting weights. A bunch of them are, some of them are playing a tournament this weekend. So, you know, they're making sacrifices that demonstrate that they love to play. And this is a mix of American kids, European kids, you know, just tennis players.
Yeah. And I think it's really neat that, you know, of the American kids that you do have on the roster, you know, they all are from the Southern section. So they're kids that I'm sure grew up knowing each other from the time they started playing competitive tennis. So I'm sure that that also helps the camaraderie of the team, that, you know, they're all working for, not, you know, they've competed against each other as juniors. Now they're fighting together as a team, trying to, you know, beat, you know, Furman and all these other schools in the area. So there's some pride in the Southern section as well.
100%. I mean, I go to, you know, I go to Kalamazoo or I go to National Clays or whatever. I don't have a bias towards Southern kids, but I'm a little more well known, I think, in the South. I mean, I know that my school is a little more well known in the South. I've recruited kids from all of the country, and I think it just kind of turned out that I have most, you know, have my Americans are Southern kids.
And it makes sense, you know, it's like you say, it's a mid-major school, so it may not have a national reputation, but you know, in the South, we're certainly aware of it, and certainly in South Carolina, it's a very, very, you know, well-known school and well-respected. So that makes total sense.
Good. Yep. And so I know a lot. I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I know a lot of their coaches and I know people that way, and mm-hmm. coaches will call me.
Yeah. So, and sorry, getting back to Ash, I know that he spent some time at one of the academies in Charleston, and you guys live in Spartanburg, which is maybe a couple hours away. So what was, you know, growing up in, you know, Spartanburg's maybe a smaller town that may not have all the tennis, you know, necessities that, you know, a bigger city might have. So give us a little bit of background on, you know, sort of what your thoughts were and his development meant, and, you know, why he went there maybe for some time.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, South Carolina has pretty good junior tennis. So he was a good Southern player, good national player. I mean, he went to LTP Academy in Charleston when he was in the 11th grade and half of 12th grade had to come home because of COVID. But you know, prior to that, he was a darn good player. I mean, they lost, I think, quarterfinals of doubles Kalamazoo in the 16s. He beat a lot of really good. I mean, he beat a lot of players. You'd say these guys are famous kind of as far as national level junior tennis. I got a phone call from Randy Pate saying we'd like Ash to come join our academy. I said, fantastic. Matter of fact, he said, I got a job for Ash. He can come to our academy. I said, well, where's he going to live? He said, I'll find him a place to live. I said, no, he can only come if he lives with you. So Randy let him live in his garage, which was awesome. And he got to go to school there. They have a great school, and he got to be part of that. And it was really, you know, I think that, you know, Ash on my college team, I think Ash going away for a year and a half and having other coaches really kind of helped him in saying, you know, I can come back and play for my dad. Because
Yeah, because like you say, probably, you know, if he had never left, he would maybe not be as, you know, his thinking might be, I need to get away, I need to see something else, to see, you know, what else is out there. But giving him that opportunity to see that before he had to make that decision, now he has an informed, you know, mindset as to, you know, what the outside sees of Wofford as opposed to just being the insider.
Yeah, Ash has had so many people pour into him. I would say I'm one of Ash's coaches. He's had so many other people pour into him that I'm just eternally grateful to. And he got that down in Charleston. He had wonderful people pour into him.
Yeah. So what was his college recruiting like? I mean, it's got to be a pretty unique situation where your dad's a Division I coach, and you know, did he look at Wofford only, or did he look at others and just sort of, you know, try and keep the family out of it, or what was the thinking there with his recruitment?
Yeah, he did. He looked at others, and you know, I think like the coach is really important, and so when Ash was going through that process, I kind of had inside information. I would say things like, you know, Ash, you can play for him. You need to go visit. You need to go talk to them. He's a good person. He's a good coach. And then quite frankly, there were others I'd say, you know, I'm not so sure that's who I would want to play for. But that was more on the character side of the coach. Right. And there are so many good ones out there. And he did explore that. And I remember we were in the car one day and he said, I know where I'm going to college. And I said, where? And he said, I'm going to Wofford. And I said, you're kidding me. And he said, no, I think I pulled over, you know, couldn't believe it. I was so excited and, you know, gave him a hug. And that was kind of how that worked. He came here. I think, it's been great. But it was, you know, he needed to look, and Ash is very independent. You know, he traveled. He and Mark, who I mentioned earlier, traveled all over Europe last summer, kind of playing tournaments on their own, and had an unbelievable experience that way, and.
So tell me, so now, you know, say the season's over, you know, you got some new guys coming in, some players leaving, you know, what are the players going to be doing this summer? You know, you mentioned some of them will be playing some tournaments. What kind of tournaments will they be playing? The ITAs, some money tournaments, futures?
Right. So, let's see, Will Fullett, who's on our team, he's playing a UTR event money tournament in Atlanta this weekend. I had a couple guys play a money event in Columbia, South Carolina 2 weeks ago. They lost in the finals of doubles, great doubles tournament. Ash is playing at Manker Patton. They have a great money tournament in Chattanooga this weekend. Some really good players. He's heading up there tomorrow. So they're my incoming guys are playing. They're playing a lot. I mean, this is, you know, summertime. That's when you they're working on some weaknesses. They're working on, I mean, they're developing, they're working on strengths, they're competing. All kinds of money tournaments is what they're mostly playing.
Good. Yeah, there's some really high level tournaments out there. They're hard to find, at least, you know, for me. Maybe you guys have a better eyesight to seeing those, but you see some of these things pop up and you're like, wow, that's a great tournament, you know, in Virginia or South Carolina, wherever the place may be. But those are definitely out there. And I know the ITA has a whole summer series with a lot of tournaments, yep, too. So there's a lot of opportunities. Are you guys hosting anything?
We're not hosting anything. I wish we were. Like I said, I'm getting ready to kick off my camps and then I'll be doing some recruiting and just kind of run out of time that way. Yeah. But we're getting a new facility. We're getting a new building this summer, which is really exciting. So we've got a lot of construction going on at our facility.
What's that new facility going to entail?
Yeah. So we have a beautiful facility right in the middle of our campus, 11 nice courts. And we're getting we've had a building, but we're getting a new building, expanded modern locker room, beautiful lockers, small training room, new offices, a new team meeting room, training room with, you know, stationary bikes for the guys to warm up on and a ice tub and all that kind of stuff right in the middle of campus. They're doing construction as we speak. But that's going to be really nice. What a gift. The college and friends of the college did that for us. So I'm pumped for the players.
That's awesome. That sounds really good. So let me ask you, this is one of the questions I always like to ask is, you know, of coaches is, what's the biggest waste of time on the practice court?
Baseline games to 11.
Explain that. Why is that?
It's not really relevant.
I agree. Yeah.
It's not really relevant.
Right.
Let's be smart. You know, let's be smart. What's relevant?
Explain why that's not relevant.
Well, gosh, I'm watching the French Open and I'm going, you know, serve and returns are so important, right?
Exactly.
I mean, they're so important. And let's be really good at a first serve and that has a purpose. And let's be really good at a second serve and that has a purpose. And let's be offensive on our second serve. Let's be offensive on our second serve. Okay. So how many young people are being offensive on their second serve? We're trying to get offensive on our second serves, but first serve, second serve, serve plus one. There's so many things that we can work on that really doesn't involve playing ground stroke points to 11. I'm not opposed to doing that once, but it's not really much of a building block.
Well, don't you think though it's sort of, and I agree with you at high level, but don't you think if you're dealing with an 8-9 year old, I mean, they've got to be able to hit a forehand, backhand, make balls.
And, yeah.
To me, it's sort of part of the development.
100%.
Focus on it a lot younger, but at 16, 17, that shouldn't be the focus.
Yes. 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 For sure. You got to be able to make balls at a young age, right? And that's who wins at a young age is making balls. But you can't, you know, as you get older, you can't just, if you're just making balls, well, the other guy's not just making balls, he's attacking you and you're trying to just make balls. that's you're at a huge disadvantage.
Yeah, you're on defense. One of the things I tell my son all the time is that what's the point of every point or goal of every point? It's to get on offense. It's to get on offense. Yeah. Right. If you're just hanging out there neutral, eventually you're going to hit a short ball and they're going to get on offense. So take the advantage when they give you the advantage, right? One of the things I wonder often is when you look at an 11 and a half UTR kid, and then you look at a 12 and a half UTR, a 13 UTR kid, what's the difference? I mean, I know it can be generalized. It may be serve. It may be they don't think through the points well. They don't find the opponent's weaknesses and exploit them. But if you were able to generalize it, if you're looking at a kid you're recruiting that's an 11 and a half and a kid you're recruiting that's a 13, what's the difference?
I mean, I think the first thing, and so what's the difference in a good player and a great player? I mean, the first thing, I mean, let's look at the pros. Like, why is Djokovic so good? He plays the big points better than everybody else.
And you know, Scott and I have this conversation a lot. Craig O'Shaughnessy does a lot of the research.
Yep.
Around, you know, how long points are, all that kind of stuff. And the points are short early in the game, but you get to deuce, you get to add out, add in, they get longer.
Yep.
Right. And so I think we overgeneralize that all in the pros points are less than four balls. That's true overall, but let's get to the important ones and they tend to be longer. Would you agree?
For sure. And you go, well, I mean, so I talked about how important serves and returns are. I mean, and that has a lot to do with the shortness of that point. Like, these guys are serving, they're hitting their spots, they're really good on the serving side. So it's serve plus one. I mean, if they don't serve well, then the points are going to be longer. But if they don't serve well, they're not a very good player. They're going to serve well. You know, they're going to serve.
I agree.
And then the next thing is, I mean, it's kind of like saying, well, hey, I got a really good outfield in baseball. Well, okay, that's fine. How good's your pitching? Well, my pitching's fantastic. Well, you got a really good team then.
But also, can your outfielder hit? Because if all they can do is field, I can find plenty of those.
Right. So that's what I think. I mean, that's what the good players do. The great players, they play the big points well. Now they have the tools to play the big points well too, right?
What? So give me an example of those tools. And then don't just say big forehand, big serve. Like,
no.
Be more detailed.
No. So, well, I mean, can you step up and hit a backhand down the line?
Okay. So when you get that short ball on the backhand side, can you take advantage?
Do you have the, and can you do it? Do you have the courage to do it? And can you execute it on a big point?
Which to me, when I watch Nadal, that a lot of his stuff is just being able to execute it.
Yeah. So, I mean, Nadal, what a great competitor, right? I mean, would you say his technique's unbelievable? I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't really think that his technique's unbelievable. Is his fart unbelievable? Yeah, I'm convinced his fart's unbelievable. 100%. As we're talking about that, I mean, I can kind of visualize in him stepping up and hitting a big shot on a big point when it counts, seeing a fist pump. That's classic Nadal.
And so for you, the 1% at the top becomes almost, I mean, if they have a big serve, they can hold.
Yep.
Right. And that's the basis for just getting over that 10 UTR range. Wouldn't you say, just can you hold your serve?
Well, and I would say, okay, and I would say they have a good serve. Okay. It doesn't have to be a big serve. Big is good. Big's great. But they have to have a good serve.
In other words, they can hit flat, slice, kick where they need to hit it.
They can hit all the spots and they can do it religiously.
Got it. And so then they can hold. So that gets them into a range of 10, 10 and a half. Then what you're saying, then being able to play the big points and execute starts to accelerate them beyond that.
So
let me ask you this. Would you say your kids that are an 11 and your kids that are a 12 are basically the same from a strokes and things coaches can coach, and then it becomes almost intangible internal?
Yeah. For sure. I mean, because you can, in tennis, you can all different body types can win, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can do this so many different ways. You know, you can do it. You can win from different body types, but you've got to be a competitor. And so, you know, are you gonna get that mid-court ball and come forward and put pressure on the other guy? Are you gonna attack that mid-court ball? Is that mid-court ball, is that fun for you? Or is that just are you gonna back off of it?
Hit it, you roll it in and go back to the baseline. Have you ever had a kid that you recruited in the, say, the 10 and a half, 11 range that mm-hmm. developed into something well beyond that? I know we talked about a player playing Wimbledon in doubles, but what's an example sure. of a player that came in and maybe their body changed and some of their weaknesses became strengths? What are some of those examples?
I mean, I had a kid a couple of years ago, Omar Williams, who became, he came in, he would have been a 10 and a half and he left here well above a 12.
What led to that? What would you say led to that? Was it something simple as he got in the weight room and grew? I mean, what was it?
He was always fast. Okay. He was fast, but he was fast when he was a 10 and a half. He was faster when he was a 12 and a half because he got more confident. Okay, so he became, you know, in tennis, when you become more confident, you become more explosive.
Right. It's like the kid you see that in practice is hitting it super hard in the match. It's the swing speed's much slower because of a lack of confidence.
My gosh. Omar was playing with house money. You know, he wasn't a great junior, but he was okay. I'm talking about he was a 3-star kid. If you look at to his recruiting kind of thing, and he left here, he was a blue chip kind of thing, like really good, but to be able to play free, and just ate it up, you know, just live free, like every day was a privilege.
I love it. And so, tell me one last. Do the opposite. Did you ever have a kid that had all the physical tools? And that sounds like what you just described. Big serve, big tall kid, could hit the crap out of the ball, and they came at maybe a 10 and a half and left at a higher UTR because of, and I know you just described one on confidence, but maybe they changed their game style or maybe they realized, you know, how to play. Do you have any examples like that?
Yeah, but I think it is mostly confidence that, you know, I mean, we've had players where, like, okay, we've played with their grip a little bit or their serves got a little, but it's, you know, are they having fun? That's where it really, are they, you know, like, are they ambitious? Are they having a great time? I mean, now that player's going to get better. That's what I see. I mean, I see players just, they grow. I mean, the biggest growth, you know, from a kid. So I'm recruiting a kid, he's 17, 18. I mean, he's a different person at 21, for crying out loud, right? He's bigger, he's stronger, but he comes in as a boy, and now he's a man. And that's what happens. And so, you know, is he how does he feel about himself?
That's interesting. Hey, Ron, I've got to wrap this up here real quick. I'm sorry, but before we go, I do want to ask you about the project you're working on. You know, it's hard comes first. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I have two kids. We've talked about one of them. My other son, so that's Ash. My other son, Cole, runs cross country at Gardner Webb. Cole has autism. And that has been wonderful, but that has been tough, right? And I think it's helped Ash in a lot of ways. It's been hard on my family. It's been beautiful. And when I, you know, the kids that I coach are they're top 1%. And I have a child with autism who's super cool. I mean, he's gonna graduate from college in December, but you know, my experience with this book project that I'm working on, Hard Comes First, Hard, I've got a website, hardcomesfirst.com. Log on to it. It'll send you the first chapter. And it's a book about high level tennis, but it's a book about, it's a book about life. And it's a book about, most of my best players have had something hard that they've had to overcome. And that's what shapes them. And that's what makes them a great player, whether it's just something in their family, an injury, something. Hard comes first, then the good stuff comes.
That sounds really neat. I will definitely take a look at that. But you're right. You know, some of these kids that do achieve high level success have had to overcome something, and that overcoming that thing has generally been a thing that's catapulted them to the to those higher levels.
So that's what I want people to see is don't be scared of the hard, because right. the hard's going to take you someplace you've never imagined.
Right, right, for sure. Yeah, like you said, we, you know, so many times we try and make things easy, we try and throw things out of the way, and you know that doesn't build the character and the, yep. The traits that you need to, because life's never, I mean, so sooner or later it's going to be hard,
right?
And, you know, the sooner you can tackle that, the better you're going to be in the long run.
You got it.
This was fantastic. What a great discussion, and sounds like a lot of parents need to check out Wofford and come visit you.
Thank you. Yeah, come on. It's a great place.
We're going to make Wofford the next big thing.
That's right. Viral. Make Wofford go viral in tennis. Yeah. We need to come out and visit a match sometime this year.
Come on. Come on.
Definitely got to do that. We got to find some tournaments in the Greenville area and stop by and see Wofford for sure.
Thank you. Well, Rod, thanks so much for being on.
My pleasure.